which is clear, is to have a connection with the followers of Imam alayhi salam, because they needed to know the word of Imam, what are the responsibilities they have. Many questions and also many monetary affairs came to the way of Imam alayhi salam, like khums, for example, as we have in our religion. So Imam alayhi salam had to manage them, had to handle them. So through this office and through this agency, Imam alayhi salam was able to do so much. In different cities, we see in the history that different people were assigned.
I was just thinking about this idea of the agency. I think that really did help the Shia, the Shia at the time, to get used to not seeing the Imam.
Yes.
And that pretty much helped out his son, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala.
Yes, very well said. Absolutely. Especially for Imam Askari alayhi salam, because Imam alayhi salam knew that after him, his son is going to not live a normal life of Imam. So Imam alayhi salam prepared people and the followers and the Shia much more for this kind of indirect relationship between themselves and Imam alayhi salam.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Nawi. Unfortunately, we have to take a short break. Dear brothers and sisters, please stay tuned. We will continue our conversation about Imam al-Askari's life and the way that he was living in hardship. Thank you very much.
The 11th Shia leader, Imam Hassan ibn Ali, also known as Hassan al-Askari, was born in Holy Medina on 10th of Rabi' al-Thani, 232 after Hijra. Imam Hassan al-Askari accompanied his father, Imam Hadi, to Samarra and lived his entire life in this city. The strict supervision of the Abbasid caliphs had made it hard for the Shia Muslims to communicate with their leader, Imam Hassan al-Askari. Mostly, it was Uthman ibn Sa'id, a deputy and trusted companion of Imam Hassan al-Askari, who could communicate with this holy imam. Although a young boy, Imam Hassan al-Askari was widely respected by the people in Samarra due to his great morals and scientific position. However, the popularity of Imam Hassan al-Askari had made the Abbasid rulers anxious and worried. In the time of Imam Hassan al-Askari, the Shia Muslims lived in different parts of the world, but the city of Qom remained one of the most important hubs for Shia Islam. Under the constant watchful eyes of the Abbasid caliphs, Imam Hassan al-Askari managed to educate some talented students. These students were later known as great Shia scholars and scientists, who left a bulk of valuable books and publications for the next generations. The one and only offspring of Imam Hassan al-Askari was the long-awaited savior of humankind, Imam al-Mahdi. The Abbasid Caliphate was extremely vigilant to stop the birth of the 12th Imam. They were well aware that the son of Imam Hassan al-Askari will be the person who shall destroy the foundations of the oppression and tyranny. Therefore, Imam Hassan al-Askari concealed the birth of his son, who was only introduced to a close circle of Shia Muslim scholars. While uninformed of the existence of Imam al-Mahdi, the Abbasid caliph decided to prevent the birth of the 12th Imam and poisoned Imam Hassan al-Askari on 8th of Rabi' al-Awwal, 260 after Hijra. The enemies of the Prophet's household held a deep grudge from Imam al-Hassan al-Askari. The Wahhabis have so far bombed the shrine of this holy imam in Samarra for twice. The first bombing took place in February 22, 2006, and the second bombing happened on June 13, 2007. Many other bombing attacks have also targeted the pilgrims of this holy imam.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you guys for joining us again. We were with Sheikh Muhammad talking about Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, as it's the anniversary of his birthday. And Sheikh Nawawi, you were talking about the hardship that he was living.
Yes.
By the tyrant rulers of his time, and the way that even his companions couldn't have normal conversations with him, or they couldn't even show that they know him or they had a connection with him.
Yes. So talking about that, we came to the fact that not only was it so difficult for Imam alayhi salam to live in that situation, but also to do the responsibilities, and also one very particular thing, which was making the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam ready for his son, Sahib al-Zaman alayhi salam. So especially talking about this, I think it is very important, because Imam Askari salawatullah alayhi had a very special relationship with his son. And also some of the very close companions of Imam alayhi salam had this chance to see the son of the last Imam, the 12th Imam, the son of Imam Askari salawatullah alayhi. And through these kind of visits, and through some of the letters that were sent from Imam alayhi salam to the followers, to the companions, Imam alayhi salam step by step talked more about his son, about the difficult things that are going to happen to his son afterwards, about the...
It was just to put it out there clear that I do have a son, because I think that, this connection that they had with the Imam, some might think that he didn't have a son.
Yes. So because Shia was used to the fact that first we have 12 Imams because of many narrations from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, starting from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. So Shia was always looking after the martyrdom of one Imam. Who is the next Imam? Is it like the oldest son? Is it the other son? And yes, alike with the life of Imam Askari alayhi salam, Shia was looking for the last Imam. So those who were close, for example, like Ahmad ibn Ishaq, which was one of the agents of Imam alayhi salam in Qom, right?
And some of those companions as well lived after Imam al-Askar alayhi salam and lived throughout the beginning of the first disappearance, the short disappearance of Imam al-Mahdi, such as the first agent of the Imam, as-Saman, him and his son, of course.
Yes, and these close companions of Imam alayhi salam, they had the opportunity to talk to Sahib al-Zaman alayhi salam, and also take some of the answer of some of the most difficult questions and become familiar with the 12th Imam. So Imam Askari alayhi salam, for example, Ahmad ibn Ishaq comes from Qom as a regular trip from Qom to Samarra to take the monetary affairs and also the questions.
It's a long trip from Qom to Samarra.
It's a long trip, yes. But when you are the agent of Imam and when you are going to see Imam alayhi salam, that long trip becomes very
sweet,
short and sweet for you, yes. So Ahmad ibn Ishaq, for example, comes and wants to give all of the khums and wujuhat to Imam alayhi salam. But this time, which is the last trip of Ahmad ibn Ishaq, but he doesn't know himself. Imam alayhi salam refers to his son. He says, go to that room, you see my son, talk to him. He is your imam, give the monetary affairs and whatever question you have, you know, express in that room. So Ahmad ibn Ishaq goes and before opening any of those boxes of money, Sahib al-Zaman alayhi salam starts to describe them. For example, this pocket has this much money in it, it is for that person, for this purpose, and go on, go forth. One more thing is the fact that Imam alayhi salam, through some narrations to the companions, talked about the standing of his son, about the special standing of his son among Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and especially in the time of disappearance. For example, some of the narrations that act as a criterion for us, Imam Askari alayhi salam, for instance, tells his son, Ya Bunayya, إِنَّ قُلُوبَ أَهْلِ الطَّاعَةِ نُزَّعُنْ إِلَيْكِ. I just say a little bit of the narration and then I translate to talk more about that. So Imam Askari alayhi salam tells Imam Mahdi salawatullah alayhi that the hearts of the followers, the hearts of the Shia, it flies to you like
attaches
a bird.
To you.
Yes. It has so much tendency and inclination towards you that it's like... It flies to you like a bird wants to fly and get to its nest.
So it's just like, it's like homesick.
Yes.
Like how the bird becomes homesick and wants to go back to its nest.
Yes.
And the hearts of the believers as well. With
the hearts of the believers, the hearts, Ahlul Ta'at, the hearts of anyone that is obeying God, right, is worshipping God. And these kind of narrations and these kind of words by Imam Askari alayhi salam, it tells us, gives us something to check ourselves with. So if I love Imam alayhi salam, if I count myself as a Shia, as a believer, as a follower of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, if I count myself as a Muslim, as somebody who worships God, I should check the relationship that my heart has with Imam alayhi salam.
Towards Imam
alayhi salam. How do I love Imam Zaman salawatullah alayhi? And through these narrations, which it was merely one of them, Imam alayhi salam carved a very big standing, a special place and status for his son, especially for the Shia and the followers and the Muslims, to know him and follow his words.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Unfortunately, our time has finished today. And that was very well put. Thank you very much, Sheikh.
You're welcome.
Dear brothers and sisters, unfortunately, our time today has finished. We hope you enjoy your day. And till another Light Upon Light, another show, please join us again. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Round the World with Reporters.
Israel launched airstrikes in the early hours of Sunday on the Gaza Strip, causing damage to surrounding areas, but no casualties reported. Israel claims the airstrikes targeted Hamas positions and came in response to a rocket fired from Gaza toward the southern city of Ashkelon, the second time in 2 weeks.
Israel is not committed to its responsibilities, refusing to allow in the required ventilators for the enclave amid the coronavirus pandemic. The resistance front preserves the right to give a crushing response to those violations.
The Palestinian group say they will continue their resistance as long as Israel is imposing its crippling blockade over the impoverished enclave, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic and the shortage of medical equipment and ventilators.
It is the resistance movement's duty to defend Palestinians against the Israeli aggression under any condition. Israel should be held accountable for the deterioration of the Palestinians' lives. This is a crime against Gazans.
Observers say Israel's refusal to meet the basic needs of Palestinians increases the possibility of further escalation.
The ongoing conflict comes as a result of Israel's suffocating siege on the Gaza Strip over the past 14 years. Palestinians won't remain silent. Through strikes like the recent ones, Israel is seeking to cover up its internal problems.
Israel has been conducting similar strikes on Gaza Strip over the past months.
The resistance groups here stress they are ready for any possible escalation, and the resistance will go on until the crippling siege on the Gaza Strip is broken. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
With almost 100,000 children under the age of 5 at risk of dying, Yemen slides into a dire situation. Here lies the 9-month-old Munir struggling to survive a severe malnutrition.
Munir Nabil.
This is my son Munir. We've been here for a week. We want to treat him for malnutrition, and God helps us. We're resisting this savage war.
The ongoing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia has brought a severe famine described by the UN as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
There is an increase in malnutrition cases. Yemeni children are suffering from malnutrition in all governorates, and we receive 50 to 60 cases per day. There is a shortage of medical equipment like CT scanners.
The UN's former humanitarian coordinator for Yemen described the country's food security status as catastrophic. Now, a UN analysis shows that the coronavirus pandemic, economic problems, and the war have pushed malnutrition the highest levels in some parts of the country. According to the UN study, malnutrition has risen 15% among children under the age of 5 this year.
We condemn and denounce the continued international silence about the blockade imposed on Yemen and the failure to take any measures against the Saudi coalition, which has exacerbated human suffering, especially for children.
Millions of children in Yemen could be pushed out of starvation by the end of the year as the humanitarian crisis is compounded by the ongoing war and the blockade, along with the pressure of funding shortage as the world grapples with the coronavirus pandemic.
عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنعاء.
A large number of people turned up in the garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistani capital Islamabad. These angry youngsters were outraged against India over its alleged unending brutalities against Muslims in disputed Kashmir region. So were they resentful against Israel for suppressing Muslims in the occupied Palestine.
Equally, these protesters are angry with the rulers of many Arab states over their alleged collaboration with India and particularly with Israel in strengthening their illegal hold of territories belonging to the Muslims. But it seems for these protesters, there is a leadership vacuum in the Muslim world.
This protest was organized by Youth Parliament, an organization of students of colleges and universities from all over Pakistan. They have been campaigning to forge greater unity among Muslims across their racial and sectarian profiling and regions. With greater unity among the ranks and files of Muslims, these students are struggling to bring an end to the atrocities being committed against Muslims by reviving the true spirit of Muslim nationhood all over the Islamic world.
We will never accept Israel. They are bombarding on the small children in the Palestine. They are Muslims. We are standing with them and they are looking for the Pakistan, that they should come for the help for the Palestine.
The protesters sounded disappointed with the Prime Minister Imran Khan, who won last general elections partially with the pledge to pursue Muslim causes. Muslim causes in the world appears to be what matters to the common people in Pakistan. The lingering public resentment against France over repeated publication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of Islam is yet another cause these students have been fighting for. This protest has followed gathering of millions of people on the streets of eastern city of Lahore a few days ago. Such a huge crowd emerged to attend the funeral of Khadim Hussain Rizvi, a religious and political leader who through his sustained protest forced Prime Minister Imran Khan last week to ink an agreement with his government to expel French ambassador and officially boycott French products in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Rawalpindi.
According to many independent institutions like Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, some Australian troops have committed crimes against humanity, such as intentionally killing civilians, since the beginning of America's longest war in Afghanistan back in 2001. A recent report on Australian forces' potential war crimes in Afghanistan has provoked reactions from Afghan institutions. Afghanistan's Human Rights Commission has condemned the killing of civilians by Australian troops and urged the prosecution of those responsible for the crimes. Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has dismissed as an inhuman move the killing of dozens of Afghan civilians by Australian troops.
Unfortunately, Australian forces have brutally killed civilians, including men, women and children in Uruzgan province. In fact, it proves that the lives of the Afghan women, men and children have no human value or dignity for them. Unfortunately, 39 civilians were killed by Australian forces during their 11 years' presence in Afghanistan.
This comes as experts believe there is not much optimism that independent investigations would be launched, even at the International Criminal Court, into the case of killing of Afghan civilians by Australian troops.
Although grounds are available to probe the case by the International Criminal Court, interference and pressure by certain powers have created serious obstacles in the way of launching investigations into war crimes in Afghanistan.
Based on a recent report released by the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, more than 32,000 civilians were killed and around 60,000 others, including women and children, were injured over the last decade. That is why the UN body also believes it's time to put an end to this human tragedy and misery by struggling to bring peace to the war-ravaged country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thousands in Paris, tens of thousands all over France are protesting for the second time in a week
against the global security law. This new law has been voted in the French Parliament and makes it illegal to film and publish images of police officers. For these demonstrators, this new law is a violation of the right to inform.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is of course very dangerous because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Even at the very beginning of the sanitary crisis, with the total confinement, the police were controlling everybody, asking for their certificate to be able to leave their residence, you know, even though it could eventually be defendable from a sanitary point of view. Now it has nothing to do with that. This proposed law is not directly connected to the sanitary crisis at all, and they are just giving more powers to the police.
Earlier this week, the police used tear gas and water cannon when protesters took the street in front of the French Parliament. With the new law, it will become illegal to film this kind of police intervention. During the Yellow Vest movement, videos have been used in judicial investigation concerning police violence. With this law, the French state can more easily hide illegal actions committed by police officers. It can also more easily hide scandals, which opens the door for abuse of power.
For us, this law doesn't only concern journalists. During the Yellow Vest movement, we have seen an explosion of police violence. One of the important arms to fight against this is the ability to film the police violence and to denounce it. So this law is also against us, not only against journalists. There is also a surveillance of demonstrators by drones.
The French government says they want a better protection for their police force. But the new French law is seriously criticized by the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, as well as by a large spectrum of the French civil society, journalist associations, trade unions, political parties, and human rights defenders. 1 year of prison and 45,000 euros of penalties, that's what someone risks for publishing the face of a police officer. Many people here say that the French government is using the coronavirus crisis to limit personal and public liberties. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
The U.S. presidential election remains unresolved, but what seems crystal clear is that the nation is more divided at any time than since the 1960s, or perhaps even the 1860s. A new poll found that nearly 80% of America says they are deeply divided on its most foundational values. Whoever is inaugurated in January will face a deeply mistrustful and disbelieving public. As the poll also finds that just 30% of Americans believe the country will grow more united in 2021. For a nation which is the richest in the world and which faces no serious external threat, such levels of disharmony are shocking even to many Americans themselves.
The far right, that's really come from almost like Trumpism, if that movement still stays strong, we can see more conflict in the next 4 years. And I think it's really just dependent on how Joe Biden kind of handles the next 4 years, and also what kind of information is really getting flown out of the far right and whether that gets filtered or not or whether that gets spread very rapidly.
Distrust is not something which grows overnight. Many attribute the division to the American liberals' obsession with so-called identity politics, which divides and redivides people into smaller and smaller tribes based on gender, race, ethnicity, urban-rural, coastal-inland, and on and on. U.S. conservatives are criticized for having a limited view of unity due to an us-versus-them mentality, which leaves little room for change or modernization.
I think that Republicans and Democrats have become almost like their own tribes where they're not willing to give an inch to the other. I hope that's not going to continue. And I hope that the rhetoric becomes less incendiary as we move forward. But I don't think that Trump is doing anything but fomenting more discontent among groups of people that are already tribalized and having a hard time getting together.
The United States is proving unable to resolve a host of enormous problems. protecting from the coronavirus pandemic, Great Depression-era levels of unemployment alongside a skyrocketing Wall Street, endemic economic inequality which has exploded in 2020, constant racial discrimination, record disharmony between genders, a Congress which is half as popular as an often deeply unpopular president, and of course, a disputed election, the third in six tries. The poll makes it clear that belief in the nation's division is not a partisan issue, as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents all agree in similar proportions. Americans can only seem to agree on one thing, that they really, deeply disagree. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Capital Sana'a hosted the first scientific conference on cancerous diseases with a focus on gynecological cancers, attended by a large number of specialized doctors and academics under the sponsorship of the Yemeni Health Ministry.
We thought about enhancing the role of person, individual roles, community, families, communities, to be sharing us our concern about their health, by educating them, by raising awareness about the signs and symptoms of cancers.
Since 2015, the number of cancer cases in Yemen has increased rapidly. According to the Undersecretary of the Health Ministry, Ali Jahaf, he says this is due to the prohibited arms used by the U.S.-Saudi coalition over the past years.
That they have used forbidden armaments in bombing Yemen.
Yemeni army says it has discovered large quantities of U.S.-built munitions at the positions of Saudi mercenaries while conducting clean-up operations in the provinces of Marib and Al-Bayda. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 in order to bring for Riyadh friendly President Abdul Rabbu Mansour Hadi back to power. Riyadh is the largest buyer of American-made weaponry. Trump signed an arms deal worth $110 billion with Saudi Arabia in May 2017. The Saudi military aggression against Yemen, coupled with a naval blockade, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and plunged Yemen into what UN says the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Military camps have been set up to help overwhelmed reception facilities, but local authorities say the government is not doing enough. The island's president, Antonio Morales, has denounced what he calls the Ministry of Interior's continued contempt for migrants and the island, demanding the resignation of those responsible. Driven by economic hardship, around 17,000 migrants have arrived on the Canary Islands this year. According to Spain's Interior Ministry, that's a 1,000% increase from 2019. In 2019, 1,885 migrants drowned in the Mediterranean Sea, and 2020's death toll is fast approaching 1,000. Open Arms, the only NGO permitted to carry out search and rescue missions at present, wrote on Twitter, "Despite the enormous commitment of our medical team, a six-month-old baby has just died. We requested an urgent evacuation for him and other people in serious conditions, but he didn't make it. How much pain and sorrow." The International Criminal Court has sued the European Union, saying member states should be prosecuted for the deaths of thousands of migrants who have drowned in the Mediterranean. In its 245-page document, the ICC says the EU's deterrence-based migration policy, which came into force after 2014, sacrifices the lives of migrants in distress at sea to dissuade others from seeking a safe haven in Europe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As the G20 summit is about to kick off in Saudi Arabia, Amnesty International is calling on the attendees of the meeting to take the kingdom to task for its appalling human rights record. The Crown had planned to promote its contentious reform agenda to the world and show Saudi Arabia is open for business. However, Riyadh summit will be solely held in the form of a virtual meeting due to the coronavirus restrictions. Amnesty International is urging G20 leaders to join the call for the immediate release of a number of jailed women's rights activists arrested in 2018.
What we said on the eve of the G20 is that Saudi Arabia's real change makers, the activists who spearheaded campaigns for women's rights, are in jail or facing trial. Riyadh is an inappropriate host.
Since assuming the G20 presidency in December last year, Riyadh has publicized new initiatives on women's employment opportunities, claiming that the kingdom is strongly committed to empowering women and girls.
On the occasion of the G20 summit, the Embassy of Saudi Arabia in Italy has organized a webinar on females' inclusion in society. Human rights groups have slammed these initiatives as mere attempts to reshape the kingdom's image through expensive PR campaigns, presenting Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a reformer.
The Crown has spent billions of dollars hosting major political, entertainment, cultural and sporting events as a deliberate strategy to deflect from the country's image as a pervasive human rights violator, to whitewash its dismal rights record.
Saudi Arabia is using the G20 meeting in Riyadh to build legitimacy. Bear in mind that bin Salman is behind the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The kingdom is cashing in on Donald Trump's staunch support all along the way.
Saudi Arabia is the first Arab nation to host the G20 summit. The meeting of the leaders of the world's most industrialized countries and emerging economies will be held on November 21st and 22nd. Max Civili, Rome.
A high-level conference focusing on the EU's treatment of refugees has just concluded in the European Parliament, Brussels. During the event, the 27-nation bloc's migration and asylum policy was slated. It appears a new crisis is emerging at sea as desperate African refugees try to reach EU territory.
Look what is already happening in the Atlantic. Hundreds of people are trying to reach the Canary Islands. Through the Atlantic, one of the most perilous routes in the world, they are dying there.
The EU unveiled a new asylum policy in September, but critics say the focus is on closing the bloc's borders instead of respecting international law and upholding the EU's much trumpeted values.
Our staff has spoken out against policies which are directly responsible for this unimaginable human suffering. Time and again, European nations and institutions have failed to act on their duty.
Many organizations insist the EU should be viewing immigration as an opportunity rather than a threat.
Behind all those people, there are hidden skills. We need to identify those skills and to use those skills in our European labor market.
The EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and several African nations to try and prevent refugees from traveling. During the Brussels event, Ankara was accused of using the refugee crisis to advance geopolitical goals.
It is wrong to endorse the popular view of Turkey as a victim of the war in Syria. Turkey is on war in Syria since its very last start.
However, Ankara is highly critical of the European Union over its handling of the problem. Refugees continue to die in the Mediterranean. Those who make it are held in very poor conditions on Greek islands and now Spanish islands too.
Perhaps the most compelling argument being made by rights groups for the EU to do more is because the West has fueled so much conflict in the Middle East and Africa, effectively playing a big role in helping to create the refugee crisis. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Since COVID-19 struck in March, the combined wealth of the 647 richest Americans has increased by nearly $1 trillion, largely at the expense of workers' safety and sometimes their lives, says Brett Wilkins, writer, in an article published under the heading Billionaire Bonanza Continues as Workers Pounded by Pandemic, Recession, and GOP Relief Refusal. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. A handful of billionaires and corporations are enjoying record financial gains, often attained at the expense of worker safety. During the peaking coronavirus pandemic, according to a report published recently by a coalition of advocacy groups, as over 1,000 people in the United States alone die each day during the deadliest pandemic in a century, plutocrats and their businesses are thriving like never before, in no small part due to a system rife with profiteering, opportunism, and worker exploitation. So says the report, entitled Billionaire Wealth Versus Community Health, Protecting Essential Workers from Pandemic Profiteers, which focuses on 12 of the most egregious pandemic profiteers. The delinquent dozen, who include the owners of Walmart and the CEOs of Amazon and Target. These companies and their owners and executives have benefited from their monopoly positions, the report states. But their success hasn't translated into better pay or safer working conditions for the employees showing up to work in a pandemic. It's not just corporations. Private equity firms have bought up essential businesses in the healthcare, grocery, and pet care industries only to aggressively cut costs, skimp on worker safety, and load companies up with debt to boost their own profits, the report notes. Among its key findings include, as of November 17th, the combined wealth of 647 U.S. billionaires increased by almost $960 billion since mid-March, the beginning of the pandemic lockdown. Since March, there are 33 new billionaires in the United States. Driving this exploding inequality are 12 companies whose profits are coming at the expense of workers and communities, including retailers like Walmart, Amazon, Target, and Dollar Tree, and dollar store gig economy companies like Instacart, and food producers like Tyson Foods. Also included is the investment giant BlackRock and private equity firms like Leonard Green Partners, Blackstone, Kohlberg, Kravis Roberts & Co., Cerberus Capital, BC Partners, and CVC Capital Partners. These private equity firms own several essential healthcare, grocery, and pet supply companies. 10 billionaire owners of delinquent dozen companies have a combined worth of $433 billion. Since March 18, their combined personal wealth has ballooned by $127.5 billion, a 42% increase. These 10 billionaires are Jeff Bezos from Amazon, Alice Robb and Jim Walton from Walmart, Apoorva Mehta from Instacart, John Tyson from Tyson Foods, Steve Schwarzman from Blackstone, Henry Kravis and George Roberts from KKR, and Steve Feinberg from Cerberus. The report features harrowing testimonies from workers affected both by the pandemic and their employers' policies and actions. I closed the register many nights, so I know my store's revenue has practically doubled since the coronavirus hit, said Kenny Oslatter, an employee of Dollar General, which is partly owned by the global financial behemoth BlackRock. But we workers haven't gotten any extra money, even though we are risking our health and our family's health to keep stores running. Courtesy Brown, an Amazon Fresh warehouse worker in New Jersey and organizer with the worker advocacy group United for Respect, said, while Amazon's Jeff Bezos is on track to become the world's first trillionaire, the frontline workers like me who've built his fortune are treated like we are disposable. Brown, Amazon Fresh warehouse worker, added, as the virus spikes, we get more and more orders, and Amazon expects us to work at inhumane rates. The pace is blistering, and people get injured on the job a lot. People get sick. People are scared of catching COVID-19, and Amazon is not doing enough to protect our lives. It's time for Amazon's workers to get some actual compensation for the essential work we're doing. We don't need feel-good TV commercials thanking us for being heroes. We need $5 an hour in hazard pay, paid sick leave, and workplace protections from this dangerous virus. The report contains a set of recommended solutions for companies employing essential workers, as well as for lawmakers seeking to protect workers and reduce the power of plutocrats and the businesses they own. For employers, these include immediately offering workers at least $5 per hour in hazard pay, paid sick leave, and other essential benefits. For legislators, an essential workers' bill of rights, workplace health councils, a pandemic wealth tax, and a profiteering oversight committee are among the recommended remedies. When billionaire owners and CEOs fail to fulfill their responsibility during this extraordinary time, it is the duty of elected officials and Congress to step in and enact public policies to protect essential workers and their communities. Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and one of the authors of the report, wrote in a Common Dreams co-op-ed published recently, the contrast between billionaires making no sacrifice while their essential workers make the ultimate sacrifice, risking their health, their families, and their livelihoods, is both unethical and corrupt, Collins added. The report was produced by Bargaining for the Common Good, the Institute for Policy Studies, and United for Respect, and published in partnership with Action Center on Race and Economy, Americans for Financial Reform, Jobs with Justice, New York Communities for Change, Step Up Louisiana, and Working Washington.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام يا ابن آدم ما كسبت فوق قوتك فأنت فيه خازن لغيرك
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, O son of Adam, whatever you earn beyond your basic needs, you will only keep vigil over it for others.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. One of the great things which we learn about the universal persona of Imam Ali is how valuable the virtues of Imam Ali are. Now, just to give a little bit of an introduction to this, when we realize that in a lot of the traditions we find that the virtues of Imam Ali, and even relating the virtues of Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, are so great, it is truly amazing. One of these traditions I will put forth today on the excellencies of speaking about the virtues of Imam Ali. But now, why is it so important and so valuable and so greatly rewarded to speak about the virtues of Imam Ali alayhi salam? Well, first and foremost, the virtues of Imam Ali are the virtues of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, which are the virtues of Islam, and they are the virtues which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves for mankind to have. So when we talk about the virtues of Imam Ali, we tend to implement and inculcate these virtues in our lives, and that is what the goal is. So Khawarizmi reports from the Holy Prophet that the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam says, God Almighty has assigned innumerable virtues for my brother Ali. And then the Holy Prophet says, whoever recalls one of Ali's virtues and internalizes it, inculcates it within themselves, God will forgive their past and future sins. And whoever writes a book about one of Ali's virtues, the angels will seek forgiveness for them as long as that book remains. Allahu Akbar. And then the Holy Prophet continues, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. He says, whoever listens to one of Ali's virtues, God will forgive the sins they have committed through their hearing. And should they read a book about Imam Ali's virtues, God will forgive the sins they have committed through seeing. Subhanallah, glory and praise be to Allah, the mighty, the wise, the loving, and the caring. We see the incredible value of writing Imam Ali's virtues, listening to Imam Ali's virtues, reading Imam Ali's virtues, and all of this reward and this value for what? So that we inculcate these virtues of Imam Ali in our lives. Surely Imam Ali, the lantern of the path to Allah, a beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيه قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
You know, there are now translations. I'm sure Gujarati, there is a translation of Nahj Balagha. I'm not sure about it. There is. Urdu, there are multiple translations. In Urdu, actually, there is a CD, I'm told, all the khutbas. You put it in your car whenever you are traveling. If you are alone, you know, listen to those khutbas of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Maybe that can be done even in English. The translation in English also, there are actually two translations of the complete book. The better one, the preferred one, is by Sayyid Ali Raza from Pakistan, which has been published in Iran, also in many other places in US, with commentaries of many, khutbas, which has been taken from the Urdu translation with the footnotes of the Urdu translation done by Mufti Jafar Hussain Marhum, and also the translation of the very extensive introduction to Nahj al-Balagha by one of the prominent Shia alim of India in the last century, Allama Ali Naqi Naqawi, Naqad Sahib Marhum. And these things are all available now in English. Go and look at it. And this is where we have to really think about it, that if the whole world is looking at Amir al-Mu'minin and his sayings and his words of wisdom, what are the Shias doing? We talk about, organizing our life, principles of, humanity and this and that. We have a source in home, and we are not even turning to them. And inshallah, this was not the plan, but after all these 2-3 majalis that I've been working on it, the intention is that whatever evenings that we have, depending on the time of the programs, we'll dedicate on going into some of the shorter khutbas or sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen from Nahj al-Balagha. Let me repeat the words of Shaheed Murtaza Mutahiri about it. He says, the Shias, when it comes to Nahj al-Balagha and Ali, they are actually like the vendor who sells perfume door to door. So we always say, this is Ali, 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 this is Nahj al-Balagha, Nahj al-Balagha. We sell Ali and Nahj al-Balagha to the whole world. But like that vendor of perfume who sells perfume to the whole world doesn't ever use it on himself. So what is the point in about talking about Ali, talking about Nahj al-Balagha, but not opening it and reading it and using it for ourselves? And so let us not be like the seller of the perfume who sells the perfume to the whole world, but doesn't use it on himself.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
www.parstoday.com/en